Welcome back to WordBalloon.com. This is John Sundress. Today, a conversation with writer Denny O'Neill. Given his association with DC's Batman since 1969, it's easy to forget the many facets of O'Neill's career before ever writing a Batman story. From his early Marvel days to his inspired work at Charlton Comics, O'Neill was a fresh voice at the transition period of the late 1960s. We talk a lot about Denny's early years and highlight some of his distinguished runs beyond Batman and Green Lantern. We also find out what new projects Denny has coming up. I wanted to start with your early days at Marvel. Is it fair to say that you were the second guy after Roy Thomas in terms of being the first group of people to write books beyond Stan Lee?
I don't know if Steve Skates immediately preceded me or immediately followed me. I don't think Steve at that point in any case did substantial writing. So, yeah, I guess that would be fair to say.
And you worked on Doctor Strange?
Well, originally it was, I think my first job was Patsy and Hetty Girls on the Go-Go. And I did some modeling with Millie. Doc Strange was the first, quote, serious character I worked on.
Okay. And actually, before Marvel, you had done a lot of work at Charlton, is that right?
No, that was after Marvel.
It was after Marvel, okay.
Yeah, Marvel was my first comic book job.
You were working at both Marvel and Charlton then at the same time?
Yeah.
And is that where the great name Sergius O'Shaughnessy came from?
Well, yeah, that was a character in a novel by Norman Mailer, a writer I very much admired at the time. And he's Mailer's character. I borrowed the name, and I no longer remember why.
Do you remember which book that was from? Was that
Yeah, Deer Park. It was his third novel.
I just love it because, and I know that a lot of you guys, because it was freelance work and because publishers were kind of cruel back then and weren't happy when their guys were working for more than one publisher, they had kind of unassuming names like Adam Austin, I know that was Gene Colan, and a couple other guys, and I just thought it was pretty distinct that you chose something like Sergius O'Shaughnessy.
Yeah, I didn't think I was doing anything that strange. I think that we had seen the theater version, the play adaptation of the novel, just about the time that I decided I needed a pseudonym, and then my friend John Carter and I absolutely idolized Norman Mailer when we were in college.
Before getting into comic book writing, you worked at newspapers, am I correct?
Yeah.
What kind of beats were you on as a newspaper reporter?
First was the police and hospital beat. Then I became the district news editor and general feature writer, general reporter.
You grew up in St. Louis. Was the newspaper work in St. Louis? I know
No, it was a little town about 110 miles up the Mississippi from St. Louis called Cape Girardeau.
I'm from Illinois, so that's I'm aware of the town.
Yeah, it's right on the Illinois border.
Was there a lot of, you know, crime, and you know, was it an interesting beat in terms of...
I enjoyed the work. No, there was no substantial crime. I think the biggest thing that happened while I was working there was local jewelry stores got robbed. It was a town of, I don't know, 18,000 people, something like that, in the area. I was back there about 6 years ago, and it's about tripled in size. I barely recognized it. But it was just a small-town journalism job. I answered an ad in the editor and publisher and drove up one afternoon and interviewed and was hired.
How long did you work in newspapers?
At that job, about 6 months. I mean, I'd done journalism in the Navy.
Okay.
Which was, I guess, one of the reasons I got hired to do journalism in Cape Girardeau. But that job lasted just about 6 months.
And was it Roy Thomas that convinced you to take the Marvel writing test?
Yeah, while I was working on the paper, I was commuting back and forth to St. Louis a lot, where I had a girlfriend and family and such. And I didn't know anyone in Cape Girardeau, so I spent a lot of time hanging out at the drugstore. And between bus stations and the drugstore, I realized I was seeing comic books. And then I realized I hadn't seen them for a long time. So I picked up a couple of them, and I responded to it. I had loved comics as a kid, but when I was 9 or 10, they just left my life, partially because I got involved in other things. There was high school, there were girls, that kind of thing, and partially because I now know that comics went into a fairly severe eclipse. They were not there to be bought anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The little stores that had carried them when I was a kid had either gone out of business or had found something more profitable to do with the space that comic books had occupied. And then there was the whole seduction of the innocent Kefauver committee
here, yes.
Fuss about how corrupting comic books were. They were mm-hmm. responsible for virtually every evil that anybody under 21 was perpetrating at the time. So all of that was conspiring to just make me totally forget that comic books existed. I went to college. I was an English major with a minor in writing. I went in the Navy. The last 6 or 8 months of my Navy stay, I got passed the right kind of test and was given a job writing press releases and editing a shipboard newspaper. Then I came out with no idea what I was going to do, but pretty certain I was not going to write fiction. I thought when I left college, well, I've probably written my last short story. I really didn't understand from a university education in the 50s, you know, exactly what writing was about. I just knew that whatever they were doing, I either couldn't do or had no interest in doing. So I was kind of floundering. I did substitute teaching for a semester or two in St. Louis and drove a truck for my father one afternoon a week. Lived very cheaply. White Castle hamburgers were only about a dime at the time. And then decided that I wanted to get back into writing somehow and get back into journalism. So I answered that ad. Then I did some writing about the resurgence of comic books. I did some, you know, a little rudimentary investigating.
Okay.
And found out, yeah, comic books were in the middle of a resurgence, fueled by a whole lot of things, among which the rise of the camp sensibility. And also, you know, popular art was becoming recognized then.
Was this during Lichtenstein's period as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So I wrote a couple of features for the children's page about the return of comic books. And it so happened that Roy Thomas's parents subscribed to the paper. They lived in a neighboring town, Jackson, Missouri. So Roy got in touch with me, and one Sunday afternoon, driving back to Cape Girardeau from St. Louis, I stopped in and interviewed Roy, and I was completely captivated. My girlfriend, later my wife, who was with me, I think was bored. But, you know, Roy was the editor of Alter Ego, and he knew about fandom, and he was taking comic books seriously, and I was just knocked out by the whole thing. So I wrote and Roy had just accepted an offer to quit his teaching job and move to New York and work as Mart Weisinger's assistant.
Mm-hmm.
So I did this story about Roy. You've read this story a million times. Local boy makes good. Local boy does something unusual. And stayed in touch with Roy. He went to New York. I stayed back there, and About a month after Roy moved to New York, he sent me the Marvel writer's test. It seemed that he had stopped working with Mort Weisinger, had been hired by Stan Lee. Stan was looking for another assistant, so they sent me 4 pages of Jack Kirby art without copy.
Okay.
And asked me to add copy. Well, I don't think it was anything I was taking seriously, but sure, why not? This is only going to take about 20 minutes, and it's something to do. It's kind of fun. And then a week after that, after I'd sent the stuff back to Roy, he called with a job offer. Well, yeah, you're like 24 years old, 25 years old, in rural Missouri, and somebody calls and offers you a job working in a comic book company in New York City. How on earth are you not going to
accept
that?
Absolutely. So you were indoctrinated in comic book writing in the Marvel style then?
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I am grateful that for the first almost year, I guess, of my comic book writing venture, my job was to imitate Stan Lee, and I was successful to the degree that I managed to do that. Everybody needs to imitate somebody when they're starting out. I think that was a perfectly reasonable thing for Stan to ask, because Marvel Comics was Stan Lee.
Yes.
His style and his approach were in the process of creating and revivifying the art, the modern version of the old art form. And while trying to adhere to Stan's style, I, occasionally had little notions of my own. Maybe there would be a different way to do it, or maybe I could be more economical, whatever. So when I went to work for Dick Giordano at Charlton, I kind of had some stuff I wanted to try, and that was a place to do it. While continuing to freelance for Stan, I went freelance after, I seemed to only last in respectable jobs about 6 months, so I did it. Then I did some journalism. I wrote a book on presidential elections. Just general New York freelance writing, but comics were always a big part of it.
Was that about the 68 presidential election specifically? Or?
It was about all presidential elections. It was a coffee table book that was, I think, intended to be distributed as Christmas gifts by corporations who would buy it in big wholesale quantities.
I see. So then going to Charlton, was Stan and was Marvel aware of your work at Charlton, or was that all on
I don't know.
Down low?
I was afraid of two things, that Stan might be offended by my working for Charlton, and also maybe that the, quotes, respectable journalism I was doing might be harmed. So that's where the presumed need for a pseudonym came from. I now think probably wouldn't have made any difference to anybody.
You did some really cool stuff at both companies, but Charlton especially, where it seems, as you say, maybe it was a looser organization and writers and artists had more freedom to really do what they wanted at Charlton.
You had a remarkable amount of freedom. I have never figured out Dick Giordano's editing method. it's magic. I mean, I don't remember him either at Charlton or later at DC giving me any direct instructions, but he managed to pull good work out of everybody who worked for him. I think it was his personality that did it. You wanted to do your best for him, and at Charlton we were working for $4 a page.
Sure.
He was offering us next to nothing, and we still probably work as well for him as for the higher-paying editors.
And I remember Wanderer and Children of Doom, particularly, two of your projects. And I know Children of Doom was with Pat Boyette. Was it with Jim Aparo that you did?
No, that was Boyette, yeah.
Did Wanderer also?
Wanderer was Jim Aparo.
Okay.
who hit with the art the exact tone of the script, and at the time I was too new and too dumb to realize how remarkable that was. I mean, it was a series that was basically tongue-in-cheek, and Jim's art was realistic, but it was kind of had a strong cartoon element within the realism, which was just exactly right for that character in that series. I thought, well, yeah, this is what comic book artists do. They look at the script and they realize it in the best way possible. But actually, it's pretty rare that that happens. And Jim was my first experience with a man that I thought was the consummate comic book professional.
You guys had wonderful stories at DC for years. Moving on to DC, I have to ask about, obviously, a lot of the changes that you seem to make hitting the ground running. What prompted the move to DC in the first place, I should ask?
Well, one day I went in to see Dick Giordano, and he said, how would you like to do exactly what you're doing now, but at three times the money? Okay. And it turns out he had just been hired by DC and had decided to bring some of his troll freelancers with him. Now, at the time, I thought, well, they have seen the splendid work we're doing, and of course that's why DC Comics is anxious to employ us. I now know that DC Comics had just fired or had denied work to a lot of their long-standing freelancers because of a disagreement about the freelancers wanting, I think it was health insurance help. They weren't making any extravagant demands. They weren't threatening. They were kind of asking, could you help us out? Well, the response was to cut them loose, and Steve Skates and I were, you know, kind of warm bodies who knew how to type, knew something about writing comic book scripts, and I think that was the reason we were hired. I doubt that anybody there on the management side was really familiar with the work we had done.
So it was really just lucky in terms of the energy that you guys happened to bring.
Yeah, we were young and maybe slightly better educated than a lot of the old-timers, though that's not universally true. There was a guy named Schwartz, not Julius, but who wrote Superman, who had an advanced degree. And there was another guy who had a law degree. But we had liberal arts educations. We were young. We were probably a little bit more energetic. We were willing to work cheap. Had I known at the time that I was, in effect, a scab, it would have presented me with a terrible dilemma because, you know, I had mouths to feed. By that time, I was married with a kid, and I kind of needed the work, and yet the idea of profiting from the misfortune of, you know, good, decent, honorable men would have been, I don't know which way I would have jumped. Thank God I didn't have to make the decision. Just about 10 years ago, Paul Levitz told me the whole story, and I was in the process of writing an essay about Superman for the character's 50th anniversary. I guess it was more than 10 years now. And I said to Paul, well, you know, you realize I'm approaching this, I'm going to put this in print, and it doesn't make the company look very good. And he said, well, it shows how far we've come. Now that kind of thing could not possibly happen, would not happen.
Well, I know that when you see things like the new Batman movie, it sounds like all the creators that, you know, had a hand in what ended up on the screen seem to be getting, you know, some sort of compensation. And
well, we didn't get credit,
okay,
but we did get money.
Okay. Well, money's nice.
Money was nice, especially if you're, like, 90% retired like I am. That was a very pleasant surprise when I opened that envelope containing that check.
That's cool. Let's go back to that time. Now, this was, you know, around 1968, 1969, when Julius Schwartz took over the editing on Batman. I'm curious, because a lot of these guys are old guard guys. You were working with the Mort Weisingers and the Julie Schwartzes, who had, you know, run the company for a couple decades and were of a different generation. And it sounds like, given your stories and the interviews that I've read with you, that you were a product of your time and you know, came with a lot of, you know, fresh ideas. How receptive were they to it? Were they looking for any type of change, specifically with somebody like Batman, given that this was right after the Adam West series? Or, you know, did they kind of balk at some of your ideas?
Well, I was lucky in that the first editors I worked with were Dick Giordano and Julie Schwartz. I might not have had an easy time with some of the other guys, the old guard, but Julie was in many ways a marvelous man. He was open to ideas. He had his way of doing things that he'd been doing for, I don't know, however long it had been at that point, maybe like 20 years, but was willing to listen and to try and to experiment, a very rare quality. I mean, Julie and I think, first approached each other very cautiously, because at that time he was, you know, a guy who wore a white shirt and tie to work every day and kept extremely regular hours. And I was a hippie. I was, you know, long hair and living in the East Village. And I perceived Julie as an authority figure. And I knew from my Christian brother and Jesuit education and my time in the Navy that authority figures and I did not get along. So I think we kind of circled each other initially. But he decided to take a chance on me, and he gave me a Green Lantern story to write. And three quarters of the way through, I thought of something I hadn't included in the plot. Just threw it in, which I now know should have been a colossal no-no. I mean, you don't spring surprises on the editor. But he liked my little addition, and I think we got along very well after that. Also, I understand that he was used to working all day with a writer to come up with a plot. And I think that first session with him was an hour, hour and a half, and then none of them thereafter took that long. So there came a time when we really got to trust each other. I knew that if I had nothing, if my cupboard was absolutely bare, I could go in. Julie would give me enough to get me started. He knew that I would deliver on time and it would be publishable. And, you know, I, despite my long hair and weird clothing, comported myself professionally.
Was the one incident the famous conversation between Green Lantern and the black gentleman who...
No, it was way before that.
Okay.
It was just a regular Green Lantern story, and it was a time travel story, and I had Green Lantern back in prehistory, way vast prehistory, capture a wandering planetoid and put it into orbit around the Earth, and it was our moon.
That's really cool.
Lousy science, but I guess Julie thought it was an amusing conceit or something.
That's cool. And it must have appealed to the science fiction side of him, because he certainly...
Yeah, he loved SF, as I'm sure you know.
Sure.
That was his background. So that was that, and as I said, thereafter it was a generally very smooth, pleasant collaboration. But Green Lantern, Green Arrow didn't come for a while after.
Was it your idea to put Green Arrow into Green Lantern, or was that Julie's?
I think so. As I've often had reason to remember, we weren't taking notes back then, and we didn't think
sure.
this stuff was going to last. You know, I mean, it was... the conventional wisdom was that the comic book audience changes completely every 3 years. So my memory of it, I'm certain how the series came about, and it was that the book was floundering in terms of sales, and as later happened with Batman, Julie said, well, you know, do you have any ideas? Well, I had done some stuff with social relevance for Charlton, a couple of stories. Mm-hmm. And while working for Julie on the Justice League, I'd done a story with an environmental theme. And as a private citizen and father, I was still involved in the peace movement, very peripherally. So I decided this was a chance to combine comic book writing with social activism of a sort. It wasn't the sort of activism that proposed solutions, because I didn't have solutions and don't have solutions for those problems. But I thought it was probably a good idea to make people aware of them, to present them to kids who might grow up thinking about them and therefore might have a better shot at coming up with answers than someone who became aware of these things as an adult for the first time. So I think that once that decision was made, we needed a spokesman for the kind of politics that's kind of far left of center.
Mm-hmm.
To change Green Lantern himself into that spokesman would have been to really, I think, violate the character. And, you know, Green Arrow is one of those guys who'd been around since the early 40s, and he was available. He had never had his own book. He was always a supporting player.
Mm-hmm.
He was, for all practical purposes, a blank slate. We could do with him what we wanted.
You guys hit a lot of, you know, beyond race. You had the Indian rights issue in Green Lantern and Green Arrow. Of course, the famous Speedy story where we find out that he's addicted to heroin. You know, the suits were cool with all this? Or, like, were you getting calls like, wait a minute, we can't put this in a kid's book? Things like that?
I don't think the guys in the big offices knew about it until the stuff started getting attention from the press. And by that time, well, the attention was all favorable. The first piece of journalism I can remember, I think, was in the Village Voice, and it didn't mention Julie or Neil Adams or myself.
Okay.
Other people were taking, I don't know if they were taking credit for it, but in any case, it was pretty much the three of us. And I don't know that very many other people knew about it until, you know, suddenly we were getting noticed, and the notice was all favorable. Then it became a kind of bandwagon.
But unfortunately, it wasn't enough to save the book.
No, and I will never know exactly what happened.
Is it possible that there was a lag time between
sales? Oh, there always was.
You know, yeah.
We heard sales, and that may very well have been the reason, but back in those days, I don't know that even Julie ever saw real sales reports.
Okay.
I don't know that he did, but I know later when I went to work as an editor, I did really see sales reports, and I think Dick has also mentioned that he never saw the material, so we don't really know why it bit the dust. It's okay with me that it did, because we had really dealt with everything that concerned us. And had we gone further, it would have become Cause of the Month comics.
I got you.
The last three stories were, it was the first character-driven stuff I had ever written. I wasn't thinking of it in those terms, but the last three stories, which appeared as 8-page backups in The Flash, were not about a social problem. It was all about Oliver Queen's problems. We'd have probably gone more in that direction. I mean, we'd done environment twice. We'd done drugs twice. We had done everything that the three of us were concerned about as citizens and fathers.
I know that you came back to Green Lantern later on with Mike Grell.
Yeah.
And I also know that Mike, you know, later took the Green Arrow character and had that great run in the 80s as well. Have you followed, you know, where Green Arrow specifically has gone from the blank slate that you took and even to where it is now?
I am kind of distantly aware.
Okay. you know, and I hear that a lot from other writers, and I can appreciate that. But for yourself, after you've, you know, been on a character for a while, is it difficult to, you know, look at what other people are doing with it?
Yeah, I wish I was detached enough and thin enough to say, no, it isn't. But, yeah.
Okay.
After I was doing Daredevil for 6 months following Frank Miller's run on it, Frank and I had a conversation. I thought I was pretty much doing Frank's character, and he said I was getting it. I was so much not his character that he couldn't read it anymore. Well, I completely understand that. And one of my former colleagues sent me an email this morning that they brought Jason Todd back. And he was pretty angry about it, and I'm thinking, well, you know, okay. You know, Jason Todd was the Robin that we killed, and I promised that as long as I was editor, he would not come back to life. They may have a very good reason to do it. I think it would be probably painful for me to read that story.
Now, and really, as, you know, a great Batman writer yourself, to then edit the character for so many years, that must have been hard. I mean, and I think you succeeded because you had great writers writing the character well after your run. And very interesting turns, guys that are still connected to the character like Greg Rucka today, who I think, you know, really built on the foundation that you created.
Yeah, well, the greatest secret an editor can have, the greatest trick in the editor's bag is hire good people. It's like directors say about casting a movie. If you get the right people, that's 90% of the job. So I made some mistakes. I did some bad casting time to time, but basically I looked for people who were, in terms of the writers, primarily writers, and secondarily writers who had a strong interest and aptitude for comics. But the desire to tell stories generally had to come first, not the desire to be a comic book writer and get into the conventions free and get interviewed even. Greg was a great example of that. I had read his first novel, and I was knocked out by it, and kept looking for this writer every time I went to a bookstore, and then one day he walked into my office. Likewise with assistants. I always looked for people who obviously had a strong interest or even love for comics, but had other things going for them. And I thought would approach it as adults and professionals.
You use the Hollywood analogy, and obviously the trend now is to bring writers not only from novels but from Hollywood.
That's what I'm told, yeah. The best way to break into comics is to have TV or movie credits.
And you you brought in a couple Hollywood. You brought in Sam Hamm, didn't you, back in the 80s?
Yeah. I met Sam through the first Tim Burton Batman movie. We went out to dinner with our wives in Oakland, and Sam, I later discovered, was a longtime comic fan and even acquainted with the comic book community in and around the Bay Area. So I offered him a chance to do an arc for us, and he took it, and I think everybody concerned did a fine job.
I enjoyed that run. I remember reading that. I want to say, was it a one-shot, or was it a full series, wasn't it? Or a full arc?
It was three issues, I think.
Okay. And did Max Collins write for you as well?
Yeah.
And, of course, Max certainly has a long comic book history.
Yeah, I had been a fan of his Mystree series.
You bet.
So, and even after he stopped doing the regular book, we did a couple of graphic novels, brought those kind of projects together. He is a consummate pro and very prolific.
And I loved his Dick Tracy, and I loved his Batman as well.
Oh, yeah, his Dick Tracy, I thought he really brought that character back to life.
No, I agree. I want to get back to your writing and back to the 70s, and, you know, it hit this short series hit me at the right time. I loved your Shadow Run with Mike Kaluta and Frank Robbins. I thought you guys really did a great job, and I guess I was young enough. It's so interesting because I'm sure you can appreciate, Danny, there are certain characters and groups of characters like, say, the X-Men, where fans, I think, get very proprietary and really, you know, hang on to them and are very skeptical of of new writers coming on their favorite characters. And I'm wondering if back in the 70s, did you have that same kind of backlash from longtime Shadow fans?
No, I later got some of that when I did a couple of Doc Savage miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
The Shadow is generally well-liked. Sales, again, were apparently bad. But I think we stayed pretty faithful to the source material. And I did, you know, some homework going into that. I read some of Walter Gibson's Shadow stuff, mm-hmm. and I listened to some of the early radio shows. And I had listened to the radio show every week when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Was not as well acquainted with the Shadow's other incarnations. For comic book purposes, the pulp version was much better than the radio version. Invisibility is not a great gimmick for a visual medium, so any number of people have made it work.
Sure.
But the guy in the slouch hat and the black cloak with the big nose and the big red ring on his finger, that was real visual stuff. It was a very easy fit. I later saw some of the earlier comic versions of the Shadow. I thought, yeah, back in the 40s they were doing a terrific job with the visual aspects of the character.
I also enjoyed in the 80s when you guys got back together for Marvel and did the 1941 graphic novel.
Yeah, that was fun.
And also, it was neat seeing you with Frank Robbins, who I've later appreciated going back and seeing a lot of his newspaper strip stuff like Johnny Hazard and even his stuff with Roy Thomas, too, on The Invaders. And that was a really neat artist.
Yeah, very much in the Milton Caniff school.
Yes.
And, again, a consummate pro who paid a lot of attention to storytelling and had no temperament that I could detect. I mean, we all have egos, but the real pros managed to put them aside. And that was Frank. Yeah, I really enjoyed working with him.
Well, it was your Shadow that really made me, you know, seek out the radio shows and the Walter Gibson paperbacks with the Steranko covers as they were coming out in the 70s. I also liked your Doc Savage, by the way, and I know that did kind of rankle a few Doc Savage fans. It was you and the Kuberts, Adam and Andy, at one of their first big assignments as pros.
Well, I thought the character needed updating somehow. I can do a long dissertation on why comic book characters, continuing characters, serialized characters, have to evolve. I don't think I'd thought it out back then, but some instinct I had said this has to be brought up today. Now, the Shadow had been a little healthier than Doc Savage. Doc Savage was enormously popular in the 30s, and then really kind of dropped off the radar.
Mm-hmm.
There was one movie that I think didn't know if it wanted to be camp or straight.
The Ron Eli movie, sure.
Yeah, Ron Eli, yeah. I barely remember it. I saw it once. So what we tried to do was to, you know, take the basic idea that Doc Savage, genetically gifted, highly developed man, and with exactly the right five guys as his partners. It's a good paradigm for a series. It's not too far off what they do with CSI now.
Mm-hmm. I also liked the middle chapter where you look at Doc's son, who unfortunately didn't get the genetic benefits of his father, but tried to be, you know, follow his dad's footsteps, and the futility you saw in this thin, kind of reedy, you know, self-conscious guy trying to figure out his place in the world when he, you know, knew he wasn't the man that his father was.
A rough draft for Ezreal.
That's interesting. Okay. I also, in that same period as Doc Savage, and I appreciate that we're bouncing around, I have to mention the question. It seemed the three main characters, Izzy, Myra, and Vic, were all, you know, in the redemption mode and trying to change the, you know, the type of people that they were from, you know, what they were before.
Yeah, of all the things I've worked on, that is my favorite. I had more freedom than I had ever had in doing with the character what I wanted. If I had been writing serious fiction at that time, novels, I would have probably been writing about the same stuff.
It surprises me that DC hasn't collected this that series, because it really does. If you look at what's coming out today, and honestly, writers like Rucka and Brian Bendis and Brian Azzarello, I think that your question run specifically should be right up there as a great example that happened 20 years earlier.
Well, Greg said that he had read it in college. It was one of the things that got him interested. Medium. Well, there was a collection of the first five issues put together years and years ago with an introduction by Sam Hamm, who later became very close friends with Dennis Collin. And it was never published, they said, because the initial artists did not justify publishing it. I don't know. You have to imagine me giving a big shrug here.
Okay.
Because I know that when I've gone to Spanish-speaking countries, there have been question collections. And, you know, it's been, what, 10 or 15 years, and I still, at conventions and such, get asked about that run a lot. I just finished writing a novel based on the first, eight or so comic book stories.
When will that be coming out?
I don't know. I have the copy editor caught something that made me feel like an idiot. I had Vic Sage acting on information that he couldn't possibly have. So I've got to look at that today or tomorrow, and I'm estimating it needs about an hour's worth of work. The book is done, the cover's done. It'll be out, judging by the deadline I've been working under, probably in 6 months or so.
That's terrific. I hope that makes DC come out with more trades of yours and Dennis's run. And also, I'm hoping that the questions part in the current story, 52, will create that kind of interest in your run and the question.
Well, we can keep our fingers crossed.
Absolutely. I did want to, as we bounce back and forth, I wanted to get back to the early 70s and your take on Superman. It was only a year, am I right?
Like, yeah.
12 issues?
Something like that.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember, you know, the classic Neil Adams cover of the kryptonite shackles being broken by him expanding his chest and the symbolism that it involved. I mean, you got rid of kryptonite, but you also got rid of half of Superman's powers.
Yep.
And also, you got rid of the Daily Planet and put him at WGBS.
That was Julie's.
Oh, okay.
Contribution. Yeah, my first wife pointed out that had I done that 20 years later, we'd have gotten rich. But at the time, it was, you know, it was just an assignment like any other.
It created a lot of waves in the press. I remember seeing at a barbershop, the Gentleman's Quarterly, where they focused on how Clark Kent kind of ditched the blue suit and all of a sudden had a new wardrobe in that.
I love that credit, because I'm a guy who lives his life in blue jeans and T-shirts, and I wrote for Gentleman's Quarterly.
With that, what you did with Wonder Woman, and also the question, the I Ching character that you brought into the DC Universe, and this sensei that kind of, you know, led, you know, these people. This was obviously an area that you were studying yourself and wanted
to
bring it.
Well, yeah, I that was the beginning of a lifelong interest in Asian philosophy and Asian religions and so on. I kind of regret the I Ching thing, because it can be looked at as disrespecting, one of the great classics of Chinese literature. I kind of wish I'd given him a different name.
Mm-hmm. With the question series, you always have your recommended reading in the letters column.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that was just kind of an interesting path that you took, especially for the question. And it fit the character perfectly as well. It was, you know, him asking his own place in the universe and the way he would handle each problem that was presented to him.
Yeah, so the recommended reading didn't always have anything to do with the story. Sometimes it was just stuff that I found interesting. I think I, recommended a cookbook one month because, you know, somebody had given it to me for Christmas and it was a good cookbook.
Well, let's get back to Superman and the depowering of Superman. I guess it was felt that it had gotten to a point where him pushing planets around was just a little too fantastic, and there was really nothing that could stop the guy.
Well, that was kind of my take on it. If I was going to take this job that Julie offered, I have trouble with godlike characters. And at that point in his evolution, Superman could have, you know, put any of the Olympians, starting with Zeus, in his pocket. I mean, he was really a godlike character. So just simple practical writer considerations. How do you put God in a conflict situation? Yeah, you can do it once or twice, but how do you do it every month and still remain consistent and credible within the, you know, character as you presented him? It just made good dramatic sense for me to take him down a few notches. It was more that than anything else that prompted those changes.
I really enjoyed the story that you told, and thought the sand creature, that the alien that took his powers and slowly became a mirror image of him, I thought that was a really neat story. And also even that low point where he was losing his powers and really had to face the group of criminals in an alley and just really had to, like, resort to just brawling with them and was able to take him down. I thought that was a really neat moment at an interesting time when the books were still being written for, you know, primarily a 12-year-old audience.
Yeah, but they were written for the 12-year-old in us. I mean, did Mark Twain write Huckleberry Finn for some unknown child out there? Or did he write it for the 12-year-old Sam Clemens?
No, I got you. How about Richard Dragon? Another interesting character that, is it right, you co-wrote the character's start in a novel first?
Yeah. I haven't seen my co-author for maybe 20 years, and I wonder about him from time to time. Yeah, Jim Barry, who is a science writer who was just beginning to get interested in writing fiction at that point. And Jim was played guitar at my first wedding. He was in the peace movement. We were both writers, both commercial writers, as opposed to people who wrote essays for magazines, little alternate magazines.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know which one of us suggested trying to do what we hoped would become a series. But we did a proposal the way you did sold those novels in those days. An outline and, you know, three chapters, 30 pages, something like that. And we got the assignment for a pathetically small amount. And we did it. It was a weird collaboration because Jim was a guy who got up at 5 every morning and was hard at work by 6. I was a guy who started work often at 11 p.m. and worked, you know, until I had run out of steam, so I could call Jim at the end of my work day and compare notes with him and decide what we were going to do next, and then Jim, it was like passing the torch.
Sure.
And for the last week, we were flat up against the deadline, so we went up to a farmhouse that Jim owned in upstate New York, and it was dueling typewriters sitting across from each other. Every once in a while breaking to run the stuff to a typist who was about to have a baby and was willing to type for us until that event happened. And we scrambled and we got the thing done.
After the book, how did it become the comic book series?
Well, way back, I had seen the first of the Hong Kong movies to get any kind of wide release over here, Five Fingers of Death. By that time, I was interested in martial arts. Then the Bruce Lee phenomenon happened. So I, and especially Billy Jack.
Sure.
So I went to the powers that be at DC and suggested we do a martial arts themed comic book. It seemed like great, natural fit, visual, lots of excuses for action. And I was told, I will never forget this from it besuited executive. I don't like the numbers. I don't know what numbers he was talking about. Anyway, I said, okay, we're not going to do that. Murphy Anderson would have, you know, talked to me about wanting to draw a Billy Jack, which was a Warner Brothers movie. I now know it was owned by Tom Laughlin, who, you know, might not have gone for the deal. Anyway, a couple years later, I was approached and asked if I would do a martial arts book. I think the craze had peaked by then, but, you know, I had this character, was obviously going no place as a series character for novels, so we just did the simple logical thing. It was not a hard kind of adapting to do. What really came out of it that was useful in the long term was the character Lady Shiva was created for mm-hmm. that series. I have gotten a lot of mileage out of her since.
It's a great character. And I liked Richard as well. I liked both of them coming into the question. And especially just Richard's initial introduction, you know, looking like hell, seemingly stuck in a wheelchair, and, you know, really kind of, you know, presented an interesting question of, wow, what happened to him in those ensuing 10 years from the original series to the question?
Yeah, in the novel I just finished, he is identified only as Richard, and we don't get into his background.
Okay.
And it was interesting to write Shiva because I realized she's a trickster character. You can never predict what she's going to do because she doesn't know. So I, as earlier with, much earlier with The Shadow, I wrote the story so as to not ever get a glimpse into her head. She is a force of nature. You can never predict what she's going to do. You just know that she will do it very thoroughly, whatever it is. Likewise with The Shadow, I realized I've got a guy who blows people away with 45s. Boy, does that ever rub the liberal in me wrong. So I decided to treat him as somebody who's not exactly the guy who is always right. He does not make mistakes. And in order to sustain that, you couldn't really get give him any soap opera kind of problems. And it was probably better not to see inside his head. Now I know that from much, much later, studying a little bit about mythology, that those are trickster characters, and they're in almost every culture.
We haven't really talked about Batman, and I obviously want to talk to about him. He encompassed so much of your comic book career. First of all, do you still have Batman stories that you would like to tell?
Well, he's in the Question novel, and I enjoyed revisiting him. There's nothing that is burning in me. I mean, I probably wrote over 200 Batman stories, and I had a hand in writing thousands.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody from DC called this afternoon and asked, would I like to do a Batman project, I'd undoubtedly say, yeah, sure. But if I never do another one, you know, my life won't be impoverished.
Well, and you added so much to the mythos, and you brought him from the camp of the 60s to, you know, the modern take that we still see today. It seems to, you know, a lot of people have kind of leaned on the Frank Miller interpretation as well, and it seems maybe they're reining him back to the balance that you had that had the darkness, but also there was still the human element of Batman.
There's no right way to do that character because he's a classic. I mean, he's been around for 66 years, almost 67. Here's a horrible, frightening little factoid. Batman and I have virtually the same birthday. We both made our debut in May of 1939. Well, wow. So I always know exactly how old Batman is. But, I mean, there's been five or six versions, and I'm not prepared to say that any of them were wrong. Frank's was extremely dark. The Batman of the 50s was extremely light. But like Mel Gibson's and Laurence Olivier's and who else? Richard Burton's Hamlet were all Hamlet and all very different characters. That's the way Batman is. That's the way Superman is. That's one of the reasons they're still around. they have evolved to stay contemporary, to reflect the times. Characters that don't do that, like Doc Savage or The Shadow, generally survive only as memories or as artifacts.
How well do you think Hollywood has done in adapting your specific stories, not only the movie, Batman Begins, but also I'm curious about their take on Ra's al Ghul in the animated series. I really thought the animated series kind of, as much as I enjoyed Batman Begins, and it was a different story, I appreciated the adaptation that they did in the animated series.
Yeah, I completely agree. I thought the animated series, well, a few years ago I would have said the best transference of comic book material to another medium. They were very faithful to our conception of the character, and yet they knew enough about their own craft to make it good television. You always have to adapt. I thought Sin City was an almost perfect transference of comic book to screen.
You bet.
And I thought Batman Begins did a pretty damn good job of it.
I
walked into that screening with a lot of baggage.
Sure.
And left very satisfied.
Well,
I mean, by that time I had written the novel and had consulted on the video game, so I really knew the story, and I knew there was no way I was going to be objective about it. But even looking through a very clouded lens, I thought it's a good movie, and B, a good adaptation of that material to another medium.
And how much did the script change from what you had for the novelization to what you finally saw on screen?
A bit. The first third of it or so was different. I got the script, though, much later in the process than I'm used to. I mean, I did comic book adaptations of three or four of the movies, and was getting the same script changes that the actors and director were getting.
Okay.
With Batman Begins, they were very late getting me the script. I had seen a preliminary version that somebody had downloaded off the net, and actually got started with that. But it changed a bit. Movies always do, but much less than other movies I know about.
Okay. Are you going to be involved with the sequel or anything? Are they going to come to you, or are they on their own right now? And now that they've begun their
franchise? I've heard that Chris Nolan wanted to talk to me. Mary Fran and I did not get to go to the Hollywood premiere because of things in our lives here. And Paul Levitz told me that Christopher Nolan had hoped that I would be there so we could talk. I'm not going to be involved in writing the movie. The movie's written by now.
Right, okay.
It's always possible that I'll get picked to do something associated with it. I'm sitting here and they know my phone number. And, I am, these days, a freelance writer. If it's a reasonable project, of course.
And how are you feeling these days, Danny? I know you had a little health issue last year. I think so.
Well, 3 years ago I died. That's a tough act to follow. You know, I was sitting in a restaurant and talking with an old friend and her son, and she tells me I was talking about why I don't believe in an afterlife, and then I suddenly keeled over. She thought I was trying to be funny.
Wow.
And after about 30 seconds, she saw I was turning colors. So she made noise or did something. And it's just every breath I take is a gift, because I was lying dead on the floor of the sidewalk cafe. The guy who owns it is also a fireman. And he knew that the town hall, the town of Piermont, had just purchased a defibrillator. So he ran next door, got that, came back, and used it on me. On the third try, the second try, my heart started beating. But machines are wonderful. It tells you what you should do.
Okay.
If you should, use the electricity or not. Third jolt, I was heart was beating more or less normally. At that point, the paramedics arrived, and the first thing I remember is lying in Nyack Hospital looking up at my wife's face, and she was asking, "Do you know what happened?" And I said, "No." I now know that there was a lot more to it than that, that I tried to hit the guys who were trying to save my life.
Wow.
And I used language that my mother never taught me. And I guess what that's about is, well, your body knows it's just been hit with 50,000 volts of electricity three times. And it sees somebody and decides, that's who did this to me. But they pull Mary Fran out of work. She is a teacher here in town.
I see.
And by that time, you know, it was all kind of by the numbers from there on. That is something that Western medicine is very good at. If it's, they basically needed to take some little pipes out of my arm and leg and chest and put it in my heart, and they did that very well. What is interesting about that with regard to comic books is I was in the middle of writing a sequence which would have killed Azrael. Killed him dead. That's what Mike Carlin and I had decided to end that series. While I was still in the hospital recovering from the surgery, Mike called Mary Fran and said, "Tell Denny he doesn't really have to kill Azrael." that's hitting a little too close to home.
Sure.
So, and Mike was very generous and must have moved heaven and earth, because it was 3 months before I could work, which must have put him badly behind deadline. But we got the thing done, and Azrael maybe died, maybe didn't. The door is open to bring him back, should anybody ever choose to do that.
That was a long run. That was over 100 issues, wasn't it, for Azrael?
It was exactly 100 issues. Yeah, we knew the book was dying, and Mike made a decision to let it run to 100 issues, just to give me the opportunity to write 100 straight issues of something and to kind of round off the series for the people who liked it.
Much like it, I remember seeing you on the History Channel documentary talk about Jason Todd, and say that there was a character that, you know, kind of took on his own life, and people really ended up resenting Jason just for who he was. I mean, it wasn't really done with any conscious way, but that Jason kind of became a snot. Now, in the case of Azrael, he was created to be the bad guy of that Nightfall story.
Yeah, very specifically, a case of a character being created to serve a specific plot purpose.
And you co-created him with Joe Quesada. He was your artist, which is...
And under the tutelage of the late, great Archie Goodwin.
Oh, he was the editor?
Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool. And Archie, you know, what a wonderful guy. And
he was the best, one of the best people I've ever known. I really miss him.
Everyone I've spoken to says that. And I think that's a real testament to the man. So, Nightfall ends, or Night's Quest ends, and Batman is Batman again, and you're left with Azrael, and it surprised you that they did want to do a series.
Yeah, I mean, he was a villain, and he was pretty much disposed of at the end of that gigantic series, but it was, again, one of those offers that would be very difficult to refuse. I mean, it was a character I created, and somebody wanted to do him as a monthly book, and I was not overburdened with writing work at the time. I don't know that, I mean, I think there were weak issues, and I don't know that we ever really got exactly the right handle on him. There were people who were fanatically devoted to the character and really mourned when the book died. So he had much more than most of the characters I worked with. The people who liked him really liked him a lot.
Okay.
But in terms of personality, he was about 180 degrees away from superhero or even hero.
Yeah, I saw a similarity in the question in your question run, I guess.
Yeah, except that Fixage was in a way much tougher.
Yes, you mentioned you've got the question novel coming up. What else is coming up for you?
Oh, tomorrow evening I will talk with an editor from another publisher about maybe writing a comic book themed novel. Known the guy for 10 years, and we have talked about it off and on. I thought about starting it in the middle, last year, and then in very quick succession, Batman Begins, and then The Question, both of jobs I wanted to do. So I might be writing a serious novel this year.
That's great.
My son is urging me to do it. I think Mary Fran would like to see me try it. Scares me to death at age 67. For the first time, I'm going to write a serious novel that's at least partially based on my life. Wow. Gee. I mean, I got into one of the great attractions of comics for me was it's disreputable. It's not supposed to be good. When I started, it was not considered an art form. I think comic book writers were considered about a half step above pornographers. And I didn't mind that. I mean, I wasn't sure I could handle what I knew of the literary world. I'm not sure what being a writer in that world consists of, and I had no confidence that I could produce quality material. I did have confidence that if they wanted it on Thursday, I could get it to them on Thursday without the baggage of being an author. Oh, boy, that's scary. That's the stuff you study in school.
Well,
it has changed. We are now ultra respectable. The New York Times does stories two or three times a month about comics. So the ultimate arbiter of what has become respectable. If it's in the Times, you know it's accepted.
Absolutely. Well, and your body of work, I think, in the comic book world, I think, had a lot of good serious writing in it. And I hope this does happen. And I hope.
I think. Working in a kind of disreputable medium had a very freeing effect. I mean, it just allowed me to do what seemed right and natural without worrying about what somebody was going to think about it or write about it.
Well, that's really cool. I think that's excellent. I look forward to the question book, and I hope when the question book comes out that we can talk again and you can tell us a little bit more about this upcoming novel project.
Oh, sure. Be happy to.
Well, I appreciate your time today.
My pleasure.
That's writer Denny O'Neill. You can keep track of Denny's career at the Comics Community Message Boards. Denny has a space right there. Make sure you keep looking for more updates on that upcoming question novel. And that'll do it for this edition of WordBalloon.com. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Keep coming back to WordBalloon.com for more updates on upcoming episodes. WordBalloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2006.